4000 to inquire about our sustainer program. You can also visit kpft.org. Make a difference today. This is KPFT Houston.
Ahlan wa sahlan and welcome to Arab Voices on Houston's Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored commercial-free KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Today on the show, we will listen to a lecture held a few weeks ago and organized by the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C., titled Washington and the Peace Process, Assessing America's Role, Past and Present. The speaker was Professor Rashid Khalidi, the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University. And in order to bring you his full remarks and most of the questions and answers that followed his talk, I will skip Arab Voices community calendar, but you can always find a comprehensive list of events on our website, and that's arabvoices.net. Events such as tomorrow, June 5th, the World Affairs Council of Houston will hold an event titled Lawrence in Arabia, Imperial Ambitions and the Making of the Modern Middle East. The Arab American Cultural and Community Center begins its Arabic School Summer Camp on June 7th. And on June 14th, the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE Texas, will hold its annual banquet under the theme Faith and Freedom. For more details about these events and a list of others, visit our website, and that's arabvoices.net. On April 17th of this year, the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. organized an event titled Washington and the Peace Process, Assessing America's Role, Past and Present. The speaker was Professor Rashid Khalidi, the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University and editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies. He is the author of many books and publications, including his latest book, Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. We will listen shortly to that talk. There was a question and answer session that followed, and we will listen to most of them after Professor Khalidi's remarks. The voice you will hear first is that of Youssef Munayyer, Executive Director of the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C., introducing Professor Rashid Khalidi. Let's listen in.
Finally getting into today's event, we're very happy to have Professor Rashid Khalidi here with us today. Today's event is entitled Washington and the Peace Process, Assessing America's Role, Past and Present, which is, of course, a very timely topic at this moment. Rashid Khalidi is the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University. He received his BA from Yale in 1970 and his PhD from Oxford in 1974. He's also the editor of the Journal for Palestine Studies and was the president of the Middle East Studies Association and an advisor to the Palestinian delegation to the Madrid and Washington Arab-Israeli peace negotiations from October 1991 until June 1993. He's also the author of the recent title, Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. We have copies of this title available here for purchase for those interested, and Professor Khalidi has kindly signed those as well. So those will be available after the talk. Please join me in welcoming Professor Khalidi.
Thanks a lot. It's always a pleasure to be in our nation's capital. It's always a pleasure to be here. I love being in an imperial capital that calls itself a town. I get a big kick out of this town. That false modesty is so unbecoming. we all have been following, since we're all, I'm sure everybody in this room and everybody watching the live feed is obsessed with this topic. We've all been following Secretary Kerry's efforts. And we've all, I'm sure, been aware of the widespread skepticism about Secretary Kerry's efforts. There are many reasons that are given for this skepticism. One is the weakness, feebleness, I might say, of the PLO, Palestinian Authority, the lack of Palestinian popular support for its approach of negotiating from a position of weakness and in a situation of Palestinian internal division. The bigger reason for skepticism has been the uncompromising stand of the Netanyahu government, which has, as far as one can tell from what has been published about this, these negotiations, not budged on any one of the substantive issues. It's taken the kind of tough, uncompromising stand that every one of its predecessors has. These are daunting obstacles to an agreement, but I would argue there are deeper reasons to look very, very skeptically, not only at this round of negotiations, but at what the United States has done and will, I'm afraid, do if it continues on the path that it has been on. And I think that there, these structural reasons are worth looking at, because I think they explain why the United States has systematically failed, not only for 22 years, 22 plus years, since the Madrid Peace Conference in October of 1991, but all the way back to Camp David, 1978. Ever since, in other words, ever since 35 years ago, the United States has supposedly been trying to solve this. My argument is there are structural reasons why it not only has not solved it, it has in fact exacerbated it. And I'm going to explicate this by going back first to 1991. In preparation for everybody going to Madrid in October of that year, Secretary Baker sent letters of assurances to all the parties. The Palestinians, it was addressed to Palestinians. It wasn't addressed to the PLO. The United States wouldn't at that stage send that kind of letter to the PLO because Israel wouldn't have had the PLO at the meeting under Shamir. The letter to the Palestinians promised that the United States would oppose actions that were, quote, prejudicial or, quote, precedential to negotiations. In other words, the United States said in its letter of assurances to persuade the Palestinians to attend this conference that it would oppose anything that established a negative precedent or that would prejudice the outcomes. One action explicitly mentioned in Baker's letter was the expansion of Israeli settlements. The prejudicial precedential language was linked in the letter specifically to Israeli settlement expansion. As we all know, the United States did not keep Secretary Baker's promise. And ever since then, as far as one can tell, it has done little or nothing to stop the ceaseless colonization of the West Bank and East Jerusalem. This is unfortunately only one of several unfulfilled American commitments that have been made to the Palestinians, whether in this letter or at other times. 1982, the United States committed itself to protect the civilian population of the camps during the PLO's withdrawal. That commitment was not fulfilled. There are others that I mention in this book, in Brokers of Deceit. Among the other things that this letter included was a promise that, quote, the United States will act as an honest broker. This is not the only time the United States resorts to this language. In 2008, during a subsequent phase of U.S. mediation between the Palestinians and the Israelis, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, according to the Palestine papers released by The Guardian and Al Jazeera, promised Palestinian negotiators a number of things and stressed the United States' and I'm quoting here, role as the honest broker. So both of these uses of this term reiterate what I think is a central myth about this conflict, that the United States serves as a disinterested intermediary between Palestinians and Israelis. This book is, among other things, dedicated to showing that far from doing any such thing, for many, 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 many years, the United States has behaved in a thoroughly one-sided way. This is why it has not only not resolved the conflict, this is why it is, in fact, exacerbated and, I think, prolonged it. The United States has made this conflict worse. This is not just Israel, the Palestinians, the Arab countries. This is this country acting in a specific fashion, for reasons I'm going to go into, in ways that have significantly hardened and made more difficult the lines of conflict. This is one of a number of myths, this idea that the United States is an honest broker. According to another of these myths, this is a conflict between two victimized, tragic peoples, the Palestinians and the Israelis, who each have their narrative and who in some sense have to be seen in rough equality. In reality, that's not the way things are. In reality, this is an entirely asymmetrical conflict between a very powerful Israeli state, one of the superpowers in the Middle Eastern region, which is strongly supported by the greatest power in human history, this country, and on the other side, a Palestinian people that Israel has fully and completely dominated for 65 years. There's just no sense of symmetry in it. As we all know, the Palestinians have never enjoyed self-determination, never enjoyed statehood. For the entirety of a century, since 1918, the Palestinians have lived under various forms of imposed alien rule. They have never ruled themselves or have been dispersed in exile. There is clearly no symmetry here. And yet this myth would have it that there is, and that these two peoples have to be seen as, you know, somehow on the same scale. I argue in this book, in fact, I begin the book with an epigraph from George Orwell. I argue in this book that language has great importance in the construction of all of these myths. In 1946, in an essay called Politics in the English Language, Orwell wrote that, and I'm quoting him now, "The slovenliness of our language makes it easier for us to have foolish thoughts." And that's what we think is determined by corrupt, imprecise language. He goes on, "If thought corrupts language, language can also corrupt thought." These terms, honest broker, peace process, are thoroughly dishonest, corrupt terms, emptied of their meaning in the way in which they are used. And they have corrupted thought, in this case, by concealing how very closely the policy of this country on the Palestine question has been entwined with and in some senses driven by Israeli policy, to the point of a virtual identity of views between the two countries. Now, this complicity actually has specific historical roots. It doesn't actually go back to 1947. It doesn't go back to 67. It's grounded in a secret letter, or then secret letter, sent in 1975 by President Ford to then Prime Minister Rabin. By the terms of this letter, which actually was first revealed on the Israeli Foreign Ministry website, Kissinger never mentions it in thousands of pages or humongous memoirs, never touched on. And it was not revealed in the Foreign Relations of the United States series until much after the Israelis put it up. In this letter, Ford committed the United States to, and I'm now quoting President Ford's language, "to coordinate with Israel with a view to refraining from putting forth proposals that Israel would consider unsatisfactory." In other words, the President of the United States secretly committed this country to refraining from proposing any language on the Palestine issue, not on every issue. Refraining from putting forward any language on the Palestine issue, which did not have the prior approval of the Israeli government. The United States, as far as I can tell, has been faithful to this commitment ever since. Given this self-imposed unity of views between the United States and Israel on the Palestine issue, it was obviously impossible for the United States to play the role of impartial intermediary between the two sides. Now, we have seen examples of what I would call this complicity in Secretary Kerry's recent efforts regarding two issues. One was the brand new, never before revealed Israeli demand. It was absolutely vital to the Israelis, which is why they never mentioned it in decades, decades and decades of negotiations with any other party, including the Palestinians. The demand for recognition of Israel as a Jewish state. And I would argue even more importantly, the question of security, as this term is expansively defined by Israel. As we know, security includes not letting macaroni into the Gaza Strip. The security of the state of Israel depended on a certain caloric intake of Palestinians. If you argue with the Israelis, say, security, security. Now, in this case, this concentration on security has been embodied in an Israeli insistence, as far as we know the Israeli position in these negotiations, which at least has never been publicly contradicted by the United States, on the continuation for an indefinite period. There are different years, numbers of years given, 30 years, 15 years, but the continuation for an indefinite period of Israeli military control of the entire Jordan River Valley region. Now, this is a region with enormous agricultural potential. This constitutes as much as 40% of the West Bank. This is an area with considerable water resources, and this is an area that includes all the crucial border crossings between the West Bank and Jordan. Control of the Jordan Valley by Israel translates into the indefinite continuation of Israel's occupation, not just of the Jordan River Valley, but of the entire West Bank and occupied Arab East Jerusalem. This completely rules out any possibility for that indefinite period. And the Israelis have this wonderful habit of turning an indefinite period into something permanent and then saying at the end of whatever end there is, saying, and now we'll start negotiating again. So I would argue this means indefinite deferral of any possibility of statehood, of sovereignty, of self-determination for the Palestinians. Only via, again, Orwellian use of language can this projected future of a continued subjugation for the Palestinians be interpreted as compatible with the kinds of things that Prime Minister Netanyahu in his famous speech at Ben-Gurion University, or American presidents going back for several administrations, have claimed would involve Palestinian independence. These things are not compatible. I explain all of this in the book by talking about what I call three moments of clarity in the way in which the United States has operated on Palestine. The first was in the summer of 1982, when it seemed as if there might be an opportunity to implement the Palestinian autonomy provisions of the Camp David Accords. Camp David had two parts: the Egyptian-Israeli part, which ended up producing the peace treaty, and the Palestinian autonomy part, which was stillborn and has never really been implemented, except in a way that I'm going to touch on. These provisions were stillborn, the Palestinian autonomy provisions, because at the Camp David summit, Prime Minister Begin had insisted, against the objections of President Carter and President Sadat, on denying the Palestinians self-determination or control over security or land or water, or an end to Israeli settlement expansion. In other words, Begin was offering them autonomy without allowing them anything worthy of the name of autonomy. It was another example of Orwellian language, if you will. As a result of this obdurate position, nothing came of the Camp David Autonomy Accords, and the Palestinian issue festered even as Israel withdrew from Sinai and eventually reached a peace treaty with Egypt that has been enforced ever since. 4 years after Camp David, in 1982, which is where I start the book, after the forced evacuation of the PLO from Beirut, the Reagan administration perceived an opportunity to revive the autonomy provisions of Camp David with some modifications. And after consultation within the administration, the president publicly announced what came to be called the Reagan Plan on September 1st. Now, the Reagan Plan would have slightly more favorably reframed the terms of what had been negotiated at Camp David. So what was Reagan trying to do? He was trying to escape the straitjacket that Begin had imposed in 1978. A recently declassified confidential CIA memo produced a couple of days before the president gave his speech, and which actually was found by one of my graduate students, whom I credit in the book. He's published it himself. Predicted, it's an unnamed CIA analyst, I think it was probably Robert Ames, but the name is redacted. The analyst predicted that the president's efforts would be met by Begin's absolute refusal to budge from his hardline position. And the memo stated, and here I'm quoting this unnamed analyst, in Begin's view, and I want you to listen to this language because this is the Israeli position in 2014. This is 1982 language. Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed. In Begin's view, the agreements, quote, guarantee that under no conditions, that's a quote within the quote, under no condition can a Palestinian state be created. In practice, Begin effectively ruled out any exercise of Palestinian self-determination except one that continued Israel's preeminent position in the West Bank. That is what continued occupation of the Jordan River Valley means. It means self-determination without self-determination. It means the Palestinians get, quote-unquote, a state, but Israel continues to have its preeminent position in the West Bank guaranteed. The memo was, of course, right about Begin's position. It's amusing to read the Israeli Prime Minister getting on his high horse and protesting President Reagan. He quotes the Bible, and you know, Begin was wonderful in this. And of course, President Reagan ended up backing down and failed to go beyond the restrictive Israeli position on what could be allowed to the Palestinians. And Begin actually held the president to account in terms of President Ford's commitment. He said, "You didn't run this language by us. You had the temerity, as the President of the United States, to make a proposal that hadn't been vetted by us? Imagine that." And he got away with it. In backing down, President Reagan was just like five of the past six U.S. presidents, up to and including the present incumbent, all of whom, I think, and I show in the book briefly, have tried to modify this Israeli stand on Palestine without success. The only American president of the last six who did not even try, in my view, would be George W. Bush. And I'm not going to go there right now. I've talked about this subject before. So that's the first moment of clarity. And I mention it not because it's this, you know, amusing historical anecdote, but because the language that this analyst used in 1982 is as true in 2014 as it was in 1982. This is not history. This is current events. This is tomorrow or today. The second set of events that I focus on in the book, in another chapter, occurred during the bilateral Palestinian-Israeli negotiations following the Madrid peace conference. There were 10 rounds of them. The first was in Madrid. The other nine were right here in Foggy Bottom, in the basement of the State Department. And I use documents produced by the Palestinian delegation, to which I was privy because I was an advisor to that delegation. And all of them have been posted on the Institute for Palestine Studies website. So the 14 confidential documents, some of them Palestinian negotiating positions, some of them Israeli-produced documents produced by the Israeli side, many of them, some of the most interesting of them, are transcripts of meetings with various American diplomats. They're all up on the www.palestine-studies.org/ppd.aspx. Anyway, go to the Palestine the IPS website and you'll find them. These documents, in particular, expose the continuing complicity between the United States and Israel, this pattern going back to 1975. And they expose something else, the extraordinary timidity of American diplomats in refusing to go beyond what they, in many cases, completely mistakenly believed were Israeli red lines. In other words, if they thought the Israelis would only allow this or tolerate this or accept that, that was as high as the United States was willing to go. We even had instances, and I talk about these in the book, one of them, where the United States faced an impasse between the two sides and reluctantly, "We don't like to impose anything," said, "We will put forward a bridging proposal to bring the two sides closer." The bridging proposal was less forthcoming than the last position we had had from the Israelis, if you can believe that. And you can believe it, because if you go in the if you look at the Palestine papers published, put online by Al Jazeera and The Guardian, you'll see another instance of the same thing happening in 2006, when again, American mediators, so-called, were less forthcoming than the Israelis themselves. In other words, the Americans in these instances were more Israeli than the Israeli negotiators. Another striking feature that emerged during these negotiations was the remarkable continuity in the restrictive Israeli position on Palestinian autonomy. Now, this took place in spite of the fact that Prime Minister Rabin had shifted the Israeli position on a number of important issues. He accepted that there was such a thing as a Palestinian people. Shock, horror. I mean, given the previous Israeli position, this was a remarkable change. He accepted that the PLO represented this people. They had been terrorists. Now they were legitimate representatives of a people. And he accepted to negotiate with them directly and ultimately accepted to allow the PLO leadership and a large body of PLO cadres to return to the occupied territory. So in spite of these major, really quite significant changes that Prime Minister Rabin introduced into the Israeli position, the position on what was allowed to the Palestinians, in my view, was almost unchanged from the time of Begin to the time of Shamir through the time of Rabin. And I would argue that that core position has not changed since. All of the Israeli governments, from Begin's to the present day, have opposed what I would call real Palestinian independence and sovereignty because they've refused to end key elements of Israel's control over or limitations to its colonization of much or most of the West Bank and East Jerusalem. And again, American diplomats, up to and including, as far as we can tell, Secretary Kerry, have acquiesced in this. So that's the second moment, and it's, I think, extraordinarily revealing of the pusillanimous American role in all of this. And the extraordinary thing is that the same peace processors, the same people who have been responsible for much of this, going back to the Reagan administration in some cases, are still on the job today. Martin Indyk is still on the job today. Some of the others have dropped out. Dan Kurtzer is now at Princeton. Dennis Ross is elsewhere. Aaron David Miller is elsewhere. But some of the key person, Richard Haas is elsewhere. But some of the key personnel are still, as I say, on the job. Let me, I'll say less about the third moment, which emerged over the last couple of years of President Obama's first term, because I think it's familiar to you. You all will remember that the president faced relentless pressure on the Palestine issue from Prime Minister Netanyahu. You will all remember that when he came into office, the president had called for an Israeli settlement freeze as a precondition for negotiations. He called for the 67 lines as the basis for future borders, and he called for rapid progress towards a Palestinian state, which he said should be created within a year. These were not new policies. They had been put forward at different times by previous administrations, but under intense pressure from the Israeli Prime Minister with his cheering section in both houses of Congress and his powerful friends in the lobby, the Israel lobby, the president was forced into humiliating retreats from all of these positions. None of them formed the basis of Secretary Kerry's effort that began 9 months ago. I go into this in a different chapter of the book. So these were what I call three moments of clarity. I think they illuminate policies that are thoroughly obscured in American public discourse. You don't hear people saying that there is no peace process. There has never been a peace process. This is not a process that's produced peace. It's produced war, misery, suffering, occupation, colonization. You can call it any of those things. It's produced intifadas, but it has not produced peace since 1978. Why is it called a peace process? So these policies, I argue, are thoroughly obscured in public discourse by this corrupt, deceitful language. The United States has not been working for peace on a basis of equality between Palestinians and Israelis. Its policy is driven by domestic pressure, and it's aimed at forcing the weaker party, the Palestinians, to conform to the objectives of the stronger party. And those objectives have not really changed, in my view, since Begin. You can go back and look at the platform on which Likud first came to power in 1977. It's really a Greater Land of Israel platform. And you can look at the policies that Israeli governments have followed, and you can look at the positions that they've taken. And in fact, nothing has changed. In real terms, Israel intends to maintain effective control one way or another, of the currently occupied territories. Now, when they agreed in 1993 to the Oslo Accords, in my opinion, the Palestinian leadership made a historic mistake. They accepted a deal which was essentially crafted to fit the bottom line of the most expansionist party in Israel's political history, the Likud. They foolishly thought, in signing that deal with all its flaws, that this would be a temporary arrangement. It has constituted the basis of a status quo that has only gotten worse for the past 20-odd years. It, to my eyes, appears as if it's going to continue to form the basis of the situation into the indefinite future. In effect, what we have created, or what the Palestinian leadership, the Israelis, and the United States have created, is a bastardized one-state solution. There is one state between the sea and the river, and that state is an Israeli state with all of its policies towards the Palestinians. the pattern, this pattern of acquiescence to Israeli wishes, I should make very clear, is almost exclusive to Palestine. It does not extend into other aspects of the Arab-Israeli conflict. We are so used to, those of us obsessed with the Palestine question, are so used to this pattern of American complicity with Israel that we sometimes ignore the fact that on almost every other Middle Eastern issue where Israel is involved, where major American strategic or economic interests are in play, little attention has been paid either to domestic factors, Congress, the Israel lobby, elections, and there has been absolutely no reluctance to, not only to confront Israel, but to force Israel to conform to American wishes. In the book, I go over a number of these instances. I talk about the War of Attrition, 1968-70. I talk about the Egyptian-Israeli and Syrian-Israeli disengagement agreements of the mid-70s, 1973, 74, 75. I talk about the Egyptian-Israeli peace negotiations of 1978-79. I talk about the end of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, 1982. In every one of these instances where major American strategic interests, mainly in those in that period Cold War interests, were engaged, policymakers, American policymakers, repeatedly overruled Israeli preferences and ignored the protests of the Israel lobby. Those policymakers took those actions either to diffuse superpower conflict. In 1973, the United States and the Soviet Union were on the brink of a nuclear confrontation. This was undesirable. I mean, the United States being annihilated in a nuclear exchange was not something that the then administration, the Nixon administration, Secretary Kissinger in charge at that point, was prepared to make hostage to Israeli whims. And so Israel was ignored in these kinds of instances, or when it was a matter of winning major strategic advantage at the expense of the Soviet Union by winning over Egypt. In those cases, a treaty was forced through, or disengagement agreements before that were forced through, over the virulent objections of Prime Minister Meir and her successors. The documents are now available. We can read what the Israelis said, and we can see what the United States did. It paid, in the end, no attention, or very little attention. It modified details, of course. There was cordiality, of course. It's a major ally, of course. But in the end, the United States did exactly as it pleased on all of these issues, for whatever reason. More recently, the Obama administration ignored intense pressure from the Netanyahu government either to allow Israel to attack Iran or for the United States to attack Iran itself. Similarly, over Syria, the United States made policy with absolutely no, in refraining from an attack on Syria, with absolutely no consideration of the Israeli point of view on this issue or the point of view of other countries like Saudi Arabia and Turkey. Instead, the United States has gone ahead, completely ignoring all of its allies, including Israel, and begun negotiations with Iran. In both of these cases, the Iran case and the Syria case, it's pretty clear what happened. The president decided that embroiling the United States in a third land war in Asia in the 21st century was not a good idea, was not in the national interest, and was politically suicidal. And this is a man who, of course, among many other things, came to office in 2008 by opposing the first and second, especially the second American land war in Asia in the 21st century, the Iraq War. To have his legacy be the involvement of the United States in some kind of endless conflict in Syria was obviously not something that appealed to him. I argue, therefore, that policymakers, since really Nixon, have repeatedly overridden the opposition of Israel and its American supporters to not only policies that involved major interests like war and peace or strategic advantage over the Soviet Union, but also issues that are of real economic importance, like big arms deals with the Gulf countries. These were often cases where strategic interests, such as the American mini-Cold War with Iran, were in play. In other words, selling weapons to an Arab Gulf state was seen as relating to that. But they were also important because they involved what I would call the Saudi lobby, which is to say oil, aerospace, and defense. I mean, we talk about AIPAC, we talk about an Israel lobby. Saudi Arabia has a stealth lobby. Nobody talks about it. In fact, you don't talk about Saudi Arabia in this town. except in the most respectful of tones, because they don't need a big bully lobby on Capitol Hill. They have three of the most powerful interests in the American economy and American society batting for them, and they do it very quietly. You can see why the United States might pay attention to this kind of issue, major arms sales. If you look at arms sales in 2011, in that year, arms sales to the Arab Gulf monarchies came to more than two-thirds of the record total of U.S. arms exports for that year of over $66 billion. Almost $45 billion in arms sales to the Arab Gulf monarchies. This, in a period of declining defense budgets, is important to a lot of people in this town. It's important to a lot of people concerned with those big chunks of the U.S. economy. By way of contrast with these economic and strategic issues, where Palestine is concerned, U.S. policy has been made almost exclusively with an eye to domestic political considerations. I would talk, if I had more time, about the Arab countries, because in my view, they can be compared to Sherlock Holmes's dog that did not bark. It's as if they don't exist. And the reason that they don't exist is because, in fact, there is no contradiction between the interests of the Arab Gulf monarchies and many important Israeli interests. This is not simply a function of the mutual hostility of both to Iran. There are many other reasons. But there is no contradiction between American strategic interests involved in alignment with the Arab oil-producing autocracies and unfailing U.S. support for Israel. I argue in the book that there eventually will be a long-term cost for these policies. I argue that these are policies that are only possible in a situation like the present one, where most countries in the Arab world are not democratic and where their people's views are not taken into account by their rulers. Most people in the Arab world, whatever other things they think about this issue, are sympathetic to the Palestinians. Most people in the Arab world feel the United States is unduly biased, but their governments don't reflect that. Their governments are much more concerned with continued support from Washington than they are with what their peoples think. And I would argue that that is why the Arab countries basically don't count in this equation. In effect, some of them, in fact, I would argue, are on Israel's side. Until there is a change in the situation in Palestine among the Palestinians, until more pressure has been put on Israel by things like BDS and other tactics and strategies, Palestinian strategies and strategies of their supporters, this situation is going to continue. Outcomes like the increase in the settler population from under 200,000 in 1991 to close to 600,000 in East Jerusalem and the West Bank will continue. All of this, in my view, is going to continue to not only make impossible a two-state solution, dictate the fact that into the future, one way or another, we're going to have to grapple with a one-state solution. These realities have been screened from the American people by Orwellian language about a peace process and honest brokers. This process hasn't brought peace. It's made the situation considerably worse. Rather than acting as an honest broker, the United States has been Israel's lawyer. Those are Aaron David Miller's words, and he was quoting Henry Kissinger, who should know. I've talked about the patterns that have created this situation. I won't repeat them. I would suggest that this look backwards indicates that the chances of Secretary Kerry coming up with a solution to this problem are close to nil. I'm a historian. I don't like to make predictions, but it's impossible to build anything lasting on such a rotten foundation of dishonest language, bias, and bad faith. The Palestinians are weak and disunited. They're negotiating with a powerful nation state from a position of weakness and division, and the mediator favors the stronger party. The Oslo Accords are based entirely on Israeli blueprints, basically Begin's blueprints. And those blueprints were explicitly intended to make impossible a two-state solution. Whatever transpires, whatever the Secretary of State does, this is not going to lead to a just and lasting peace. That would be one in which the Palestinians end their nearly century-long odyssey of wandering. It would be a future in which the Israelis and the Palestinians live in equality, justice, and security. And the key words here are not security first, equality and justice first. Whatever solution, one state, two states, cantons, multiple states, no states, there has to be equality, there has to be justice, or it won't be lasting, and it won't be sustainable. Those are things that are unfashionable to talk about, equality and justice, in this town, but because they don't talk about them, we have made this problem worse. If the history I've summarized today, and that I try and tell in more detail in this book, tells us anything, it is that this so-called peace process cannot produce any such outcome. It will do what it was designed to do, which is to provide an extension into the future, indefinite future, of the entirely unsatisfactory, entirely unsustainable, and entirely unjust status quo. Thank you very much.
What you just heard was a lecture by Professor Rashid Khalidi, the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University, titled Washington and the Peace Process, Assessing America's Role, Past and Present. It was held at the Palestine Center on April 17th. There was a question and answer session that followed the talk. Let's listen in to most of it.
Mr. Khalidi, I want to ask you basically the same question that I asked you about a year ago on the options before the Palestinians, taking into consideration this, you know, odyssey of extended negotiations that are about to be extended again. You mentioned the Arab countries. In fact, last week in Cairo, the Arab foreign ministers pressured Abbas to extend the talks. So under these conditions,
isn't it U.S. proxy?
Exactly. So under these conditions, are the Palestinians really have left without options, you know, completely dispersed, completely fragmented, that they really have no recourse? Thank you.
The Palestinians... Thanks for the question. The Palestinians have, in my view, many options. One obvious option is to say that this is a process, according to the letters of invitation to Madrid, which was supposed to lead to a specific result in 1997. It did not. These temporary interim agreements have failed to produce an outcome. They are null and void. We start from scratch. And we refuse to negotiate on this basis. And the Palestinian Authority will continue to carry out garbage collection, education, and other services, but no longer. It basically would wind itself up as a quasi-state. We could keep the presidential mausoleum, but I would fire the presidential guards and not have little uniforms and so on and so forth. I suggest this entirely seriously because this farce depends on Palestinian complicity and acquiescence as well. It's not just the United States and Israel or the Arab states. Another option would be to end this ridiculous situation where the weaker party divides itself in the face of a stronger enemy. Any strategist will tell you that that is a recipe for disaster. You know, Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee did it in the face of the Union Army, and you know, a brilliant general might be able to pull it off. As you may have noticed, the Palestinians don't have a lot of brilliant strategists. The weaker party is probably best off figuring out some way to unite its ranks. And so this destructive, pointless division, which is related to personal and group interests and has nothing to do with the Palestinian national interest, has to be ended. There has to be a fresh approach to strategy. I mean, I think it's time to end the sterile debate about how many states can dance on the head of a pin and start from how we get from the present state, which is one of Israel imposing a one-state reality, to anything better. And what strategy follows from that is that it should be the result of a Palestinian consensus. Finally, given the inequality, the asymmetry between the two sides, it's necessary to figure out some way to ramp up some forms of pressure on the stronger party. The stronger party is perfectly comfortable with the status quo. As long as it stays comfortable with the status quo, it will continue to insist on not just the same conditions, but will continue to impose new conditions. Jewish state, everybody has to sing Hatikva, you all have to, you know, join the world Zionist organization. I mean, they could ask for anything in the position that they're in. And that's partly because of this asymmetry. How do you change that? You figure out means of increasing solidarity, you figure out means of appealing to Israelis, which the PLO, the PA, the Palestinian people have not been terribly apt at doing. You figure out means of increasing international pressure, whether it's through BDS, whether it's through other similar means, and you figure out ways of making the occupation more difficult, whether that's through the kind of passive or nonviolent resistance that's currently going on in many parts of the occupied territories or other means. I mean, there are many, many options open. The first thing is to say that these negotiations cannot and will not lead to anything. I mean, whether the PA continues them or not is a matter of absolutely no moment. It's not going to change the situation except for the worse. And that has to be realized. And these people have to be, if they insist on continuing doing this, it has to be that you're employees of this peace process. You do not represent us in so doing. because it's clear that this has worsened the situation over the past 20 years. So I actually think there are many options. They're not easy, clearly, because there are many vested interests engaged in the maintenance of the status quo. You need only to go to the great boom town of Ramallah to see the extent to which there are massive interests invested in more restaurants, more buildings, more land deals, more ministries, more cars, and so on and so forth. The same thing is true on a much more limited level in Gaza. The status quo benefits a lot of people. There are vested interests engaged in Palestinian division. People are being paid to maintain the division. Well, somebody has to say something about that on both sides. And so on and so forth. So it's not like these things will change easily. It's easy to say this from Washington. I'm not preaching. I'm simply saying, yes, there are options.
We have a few questions in the room, but I'm going to take a couple from online. Professor Khaled, you mentioned it a bit towards the end of your talk and also a little bit in the response to that question, but a specific question to you from online is, does Professor Khaled endorse the BDS movement?
I mean, how can one not endorse the BDS movement? 10 years ago, anybody who looked at the map of the Palestinian-Israeli situation would have said that there are really very few means of leverage that the Palestinians have vis-a-vis Israel. And in these past 10 years, remarkably, this has appeared not only as a means of leverage, and I'm going to quote something that I think proves that it's a means of leverage, but also as a way of breaking the discursive hegemony that Israel has maintained or that Zionism has maintained in this country for five or six generations. They have defined the terms of the debate from the very beginning, using biblical terms, desert into and so on, making the deserts bloom, etc., etc., etc. A entirely false narrative is embedded in the minds of everybody over about 30 or 40. They can't help it. We've all been brainwashed to some extent. BDS has opened up the debate in the United States. The debate over BDS has opened up the discursive terrain in the United States in ways that, in my view, were unimaginable 10 years ago. So it's not just what I'm about to talk about, the actual impact of actual boycotts, actual divestments, and actual sanctions. It's the debate around it that is equally important. Now, what is the impact? We had a talk by a lawyer at Columbia, a Columbia Law School, who has pled a number of cases before the Israeli Supreme Court, including the a suit against the Israeli government over a law that was recently passed making it illegal for Israeli citizens to advocate a boycott of Israel. So this is an Israeli law that is a law passed by the Knesset, which makes it illegal for Israelis to advocate a boycott. And he told us in his lecture that in the Supreme Court, the government came forward with statistics, which were, in his view, quite convincing, showing the actual economic impact of boycott in Europe in particular, that there has been a specific, considerable impact already of European boycott actions against Israeli products, specifically because of the settlements. So there you are. I mean, how can you be against that? When the Israeli government itself is talking about the painful impact of it, when Netanyahu himself comes back from meetings, calls emergency cabinet meetings to determine the strategy that the Israeli government is to take against what he describes as the biggest danger, blah, blah, blah. Used to be Iran, now it's boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Well, that's a remarkable shift. That doesn't mean that khalas, we can just forget about it. This will produce liberation. No, it's a tactic. It's a strategy that has had remarkable success in a couple of realms. There's no question that the other side can counter and counter and counter again. And the kind of imagination that went into it has to continue to be applied in order to make it, to ensure that it continues to be effective. So there's no magic, it's not a magical formula, but it certainly is something that has produced, in my view, quite considerable results already.
And Michael, I just wanted to follow up on that. You made a great point about the United States' complicity in continuing this whole situation. And in conjunction with what you just talked about BDS, about opening up the dialogue and discourse in this country, could you go into a little bit more about what you see where American public opinion is going and the impact that conceivably could have on our intransigent current Congress, we got elections coming up, and the political situation here. And I've always thought the vote on the Jerusalem Amendment at the Democratic Convention 2 years ago was a turning point in a large way on the political scene here.
I have to start being a little more cautious now, because I can talk about discourse, but I'm not a public opinion guy. I'm not a political scientist. I don't do that. There are very good people who do that. And they could probably tell you more credibly and with more facts than I can what is actually happening with quote-unquote public opinion. I don't know. I can tell you about campus sentiment. I can tell you about sentiment among young people. I can tell you what I sense is happening, as far as I can tell, in the Jewish community among young people. I can tell you, to some extent, the impact legally of some of these things, because I follow these things because I'm to some extent involved. And there's no question that on those levels, what's happening on campuses, what's happening among younger people, the way in which the alternative media are changing the way people think about this issue, they're simply not bound by the sclerotic coverage of the New York Times. I don't have any students who pay any attention to what the New York Times publishes. And none of them see the printed Times, which is considerably worse, if you can imagine that, than the online Times. If you actually read the Times online, bad as it may be, it's not quite as bad as what I get in the morning in New York City on my doorstep. But that has no effect on younger people. No effect whatsoever. So whereas people of my generation and a little younger are obsessed with the New York Times, mercifully, people in their 20s and their 30s, they don't watch cable television. They don't care about that stuff. You know, these lunatics can rant as long as they want on Fox News. Nobody cares. It's the 75 and up demographic that watches Fox News. Who cares? That's actually probably correct. But to your point about politics, what I would say is that none of this means that we are about to reach a tipping point where the political level is concerned, or where the mainstream media are concerned. There, as far as I can tell, money, traditional power elements, what determines who runs the mainstream media, what determines who pays and buys our congressmen, women, and senators, is going to continue to operate. And big money and powerful interests are still dominating our political system insofar as those issues are concerned. So I expect no immediate change on the political level. That'll require a lot of other things. It'll require the people at much younger, stages to vote much more intensively and with much more concern for this issue, which I don't yet see. So I am not expecting, the 2014 or 2016 or 2018 elections to suddenly, witness an opening up of the heavens and, the American political system change. No, I doubt that that's coming in the immediate future. But I may be wrong. I was wrong, but I'm often wrong.
Another question that comes to us from online, again, you mentioned also towards the end of your talk the prospect of a one-state outcome given current trends. The question is, what would a one-state solution look like in your view? And the questioner notes that it is an unlikely prospect given the deep roots of Zionism. Could you address that?
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. Well, I think it's an unlikely prospect for several reasons, which doesn't mean that it's not going to happen. One reason it may well happen is that I just don't see Israel changing the policies that have created a one-state reality. That's the main reason. So as against the deep roots of Zionism, I see the all-encompassing, all-englobing colonial push of Zionism creating a one-state outcome, whether we like it or not, whether they like it or not. There's a logic there that seems to be operating. I'm looking forward to a day when the bulldozers stop. But apparently President Abbas in Washington gave President Obama details on the extraordinary amount of money that's been spent just this year on settlements. The biggest budgetary expenditure, apparently, ever took place while these negotiations were going on. So there's a logic there which is inherent, an expansionist, colonialist logic, that I see as having enormous potential into the future. So that's one reason I think we have to start thinking in terms of one state, not because we want it or it's good or it's bad or whatever, but because that's being imposed on us, whether we like it or not. However, there are important obstacles. And one of them, of course, is this idea that Zionism embodies of a distinct state for the Jewish people. There's another element there which nobody wants to talk about, which is the Palestinians, having been systematically deprived of any opportunity for self-determination, have a very strong desire for self-determination as a separate people. And you're going to have to deal with that before you get Palestinians to accept one state which is more than a cover for a Palestinian state. Now, there are some Palestinian one-staters who are basically Palestinians who want a Palestinian state with a few Jews in it. Well, that's no more likely to happen than a Jewish state with a few Arabs in it. Those two peoples are there. And the one-staters, so-called, on the Palestinian side, who really are just Palestinian staters, are not thinking of some kind of binational or other kind of setup wherein somehow these two peoples can live together. There has to be justice, there has to be equality, but you're not going to eliminate populations. That's not going to happen, in my view. It's not just that it's undesirable and immoral, it's unlikely. The other issue with the one-state solution has to do with something that the Palestinians always talk about, which is so-called international legality. Rooted in international legality is a Jewish state. That's what the partition resolution said. That's what the United States and the Soviet Union voted for. They voted for an Arab state, but they clearly didn't care one bit about an Arab state, or one would have emerged. It was strangled in its cradle because nobody gave a damn about it. That's not what they were voting for in November 1947. They were voting in the wake of the Holocaust, in the wake of the kind of political head of steam that Zionism had developed, for a Jewish state, and then something else. And if it didn't happen, they didn't care. They clearly didn't care. They made absolutely no effort to see to it that an Arab state came about. They made nobody did, nor the Americans, or the Soviets, nor the British, nor anybody else. Even some of the Arab states didn't care. We know Jordan's position, Iraq's position. And the ones that tried to do something were too feeble to do anything about it, were divided, and had their own agendas. So to go back to that point, a Jewish state, an Israeli state, is deeply embedded in international legality. How you square that circle and turn that into a just one-state, binational outcome is something that I think advocates of one-state solutions should be applying their energies to. It's not an easy thing to think through and to turn into strategy and to figure out how you achieve.
What you just heard was the question and answer session that followed the lecture, Washington and the Peace Process, Assessing America's Role, Past and Present, delivered by Professor Rashid Khalidi, the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University. The event was held at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. on April 17 of this year and was organized by the Palestine Center and co-sponsored by the Institute for Palestine Studies. For more information on about that organization, you can visit their website, and that's www.palestinecenter.org. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. Technology Bites is coming up next. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next Wednesday, peace on earth.
KPFT has just concluded its spring 2014 membership campaign. Thank you very much for your support during this drive. Your donations keep the station you depend on for great music, art, news, and culture alive and strong. If you contributed for a particular thank you gift, processing generally takes a few weeks to get out all the premium members requested. Your patience is appreciated. If you promised to mail a check, remember to send it in when your envelope appears in the mail soon. And if you missed your chance to pledge, help power KPFT into the summer by visiting kpft.org. You can donate right now. Thank you for your help. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
We live in a world that privileges greed, encourages competition, and runs on fear. We could be living in a world that privileges service, encourages cooperation, and runs on love. Stirrings of that new world are present now, within each of us, and within the social movements we are part of. Join us on Thresholds, 3 to 4 p.m., on Thursdays, for conversations with people who are working to make the seeds of that world bloom in the present. to bring into being a world where children can grow up without ever doubting their worth, where women would have the same access to society's resources as men do, where work would be an expression of our love of the world and desire to be of service. You'll hear and be able to speak with people who are attempting to meet the greatest challenges of the present, an increasingly dysfunctional economic system and an ecological crisis that requires global cooperation to resolve. It's a call-in show, and you're invited to participate. That's on Thresholds, Thursdays at 3 p.m. here on KPFT, Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM, KPFT, Houston.
Listeners should be aware that the following